91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. Up next, your KBOO evening news.
KBOO is looking for a membership director. Duties include database management, conducting mailings, producing reports, assisting members, managing pledge drives, and of course, working closely with other staff members here at the station. The ability to work with numerous people in a fast-paced environment is essential. This is a mix of part-time and full-time work, with 40 hours per week being required leading up to, during, and following each membership drive. A full benefit package is included. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Our organization does not discriminate on the basis of age, race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, sexual orientation, class, creed, physical or mental disability. For a more detailed job description and printable job application, go to kboo.fm, search for hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G. And to apply, please send a resume via email to hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G, at kboo.org. The application deadline is 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, 2014.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along on Saturday, May 3rd, from 3 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. On what would have been Pete Seeger's 95th birthday, his life and legacy will be honored with song, remembrances, and a talk by Joe Hickerson. Again, that's Saturday, May 3rd, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University. 5 part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment. The hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. June 6th information session, merrillhurst.edu.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge in Oregon hears arguments in a case that could overturn the state's ban on same-sex marriage.
The Oregon Department of Transportation decides to stop reporting on the location of coal and oil trains throughout the state.
A new lawsuit challenges the U.S. government's secret no-fly list as discriminatory against Muslims.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 23rd, 2014. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. A federal court heard arguments today challenging the constitutionality of Oregon's 10-year-old same-sex marriage ban. The challenge, filed on behalf of two same-sex couples, requests that the U.S. District Judge Michael McShane declare the ban unconstitutional and permit same-sex couples to marry. The challenge additionally asks that same-sex marriages performed in other states be recognized in the state of Oregon. Gay marriage has been prohibited by Oregon law since 2004, when a ban was voted into law. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum says she will not defend the state's existing ban against the challenge. Rosenblum wrote in a brief filed with the court that she believes sexual orientation has no bearing on a person's ability to maintain a loving and committed relationship. She added that any federal constitutional challenge to such a ban wouldn't withstand review anyway. On Monday night, the National Organization for Marriage filed a motion to intervene defending the current ban and requested a postponement of arguments. The request for postponement was denied, but a hearing on the motion to intervene is set for May 14th. Now, in collaboration with ACLU Oregon, we bring you the story of one of the couples involved in the current round of arguments, Paul Rummel and Ben West.
I was born and raised in Astoria, Oregon, the 14th in a family of 16, the seventh son of a seventh son, so from a very traditional Catholic family. Very rural and not very hospitable towards gays, for sure.
I grew up in Portland and in North Portland, and I grew up in a very evangelical, conservative, fundamentalist home.
It's still something that's very difficult for me to resolve because I love my church, I love my God, I love my, you know, but I love my partner and I love my family that I'm developing.
We got married just outside Tillamook in the Colster Range on a plateau, and I think that's something that we did was sacred, even though when we had our ceremony and we did the whole entire wedding, we did it because we wanted to, because we loved each other, not because it was legal. We did it because we wanted to make that commitment before God and our family that we're serious about this and we want to create a family too.
Marriage is choosing to be by your side through all of your triumphs, and there when you are grieving your losses. Marriage is looking into your eyes and seeing the infinite possibilities and loving you with all of my heart. Marriage is celebrating our lives with our families and friends. My brother asked my dad, you know, what he thought of the whole ceremony. And my dad just looked and said, with a smile and kind of a tear rolling down his cheek, he said, "I guess this is the way it is now, and good for them."
We decided to parent after we were started seriously dating. It was almost like a prereq. Like, this is my goal, this is kind of where I want to be in the future with my spouse. If you're long-term, this is what you need to expect. And we both lined up on the desire to be fathers. We ended up getting involved with an agency that privately contracts to take care of high-needs therapeutic foster children.
We've been working with a particular child for about a year now, and our relationship is blossoming, and it's amazing. It's an amazing opportunity to become a forever family, which is what he terms it.
It heals my heart when I walk in and surprise him that I'm gonna have lunch with him in his first grade class, and he runs up and goes, "My daddy's here!" You know, words I never thought I'd hear.
He'll say, "Is it morning? 'Cause I feel like I'm dreaming. I'm in heaven." And that's it. You know, it's such a simple thing to be able to provide a sense of permanency and a sense of connection to a little child, but to give a kid a sense that they're in heaven, that it doesn't get any better than that.
If we can raise this child and do a great job at it, and we're committed to that, he should know that his parents are married and they have the freedom to be married, and that our family is just as legitimate as anybody else's next door, anywhere else. And marriage to me is a bedrock to family. And I want my family to be as stable as anybody else's family. And I want somebody to grow old with. And I want to be able, and I have the right to be loved and love also, just like anybody else. Sometimes we need to get simple like children and think like children. He just wants a family, and he wants to be his forever home, just like a lot of kids get forever homes. And finally, his dream of having a forever home is going to happen. And so that freedom for us to be the family like any other family is why that's important.
That was Ben West and Paul Rummel, who are suing the state of Oregon for their right to marry. The case was heard in front of a federal appeals court in Eugene today. To find out more about today's hearing, I'll be speaking with David Fidanke of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon later on in the hour. Stay tuned at 5:45 to hear that live update on KBOO News In Depth.
A Seattle church has had its Boy Scout charter revoked by the General Council of the Boy Scouts of America for having an openly gay scoutmaster. The Rainier Beach United Methodist Church, which sponsors Troop 98, says they will stand by Scoutmaster Jeff McGrath in continuing his role as an adult leader with the troop. Diversity is a key value for the congregation of Rainier Beach, according to church pastor Monica Corsaro. In an op-ed piece published today on Time.com, Corsaro said that McGrath, who is an Eagle Scout, was chosen as leader for his mentoring and leadership skills. Political agendas, she added, had nothing to do with the decision. McGrath, who is openly gay and is married to another man, initially expressed concerns that his sexuality might pose an issue, Corsaro said, but she assured him of the church's support and encouraged him to accept the posting. Corsaro says she was not contacted by the Boy Scouts of America about the decision to remove McGrath, and that the Scouts are asking her congregation to violate its religious beliefs in ordering his removal. Corsaro said, "It troubles me that our belief that God created and loves each and every one of us just as we are is being ignored and in fact denied by the Boy Scouts of America." The Boy Scouts voted last year to remove a ban that formerly prevented gay youth from participating in scouting activities.
The Washington Post reports that the Obama administration is currently considering clemency requests from thousands of inmates serving time for drug offenses. This is an unprecedented campaign to free nonviolent offenders that will continue over the next 2 years. The Justice Department is expected to reassign dozens of lawyers to facilitate prisoner requests. Department officials have indicated that they will recommend as many qualified applicants as possible for reduced sentences. Locally, the group Partnership for Safety and Justice, which works for criminal justice reform at a state level, is hosting a conversation this evening with Piper Kerman, the author of Orange is the New Black. Kerman's book has been turned into a Netflix series of the same name, showing the experience of women in prison. The talk will begin at 5:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Piper Kerman today after her arrival in Portland.
Piper, you yourself have experience with the criminal justice system, and I wonder, from your experience, what you see as the main problems with the criminal justice system that are not being addressed.
The main problems with the criminal justice system that aren't being addressed are the fact that we incarcerate an enormous, enormous number of people in this country with a very limited return in terms of public safety on those fronts, and that too often those incarcerations are disproportionately borne by poor communities of color with really devastating effects on those communities, which are already vulnerable in many ways.
And just today, it's coming out that President Obama may be considering changing drug sentencing or allowing clemency for certain people convicted of nonviolent drug offenses. Have you heard this news? Do you have any comment on it?
Yes. I mean, I'm thrilled to hear that the current administration and the Department of Justice are thinking about whatever executive remedies they can make to the existing prison population. The Bureau of Prisons is, of course, the biggest correctional system in the country. It incarcerates many, many people in this country. And federal sentences tend to be the harshest in terms of their length. So there are tens of thousands of people who might potentially qualify for clemency based on what the Obama administration said today. No one should confuse that with legislative reform to existing sentencing law, though. And that is really what we need if we want to have a smaller prison population and fewer people in prison and jail, is common sense sentencing, especially around drug laws, but also, you know, for more broadly. The United States has exceptionally harsh sentencing on many fronts. And what we know for a fact is that long prison sentences do not necessarily yield better public safety.
Do you feel that as someone coming from a position of privilege, being a white person, that you have an obligation to bring out the stories of underrepresented communities? And you feel like that's what you're doing with Orange is the New Black?
I mean, I speak for myself. I speak from my own experience. When I was indicted, which was back in 1998, I knew very, very little about the criminal justice system, despite the fact that 5 years earlier I had committed a crime. I was ultimately sent to prison in 2004, and I served a 13-month sentence. I served 13 months of a 15-month sentence. And so when I talk about the criminal justice system, in a lot of senses, I'm talking directly from my own experience. And obviously my experience of the criminal justice system as a upper-middle-class white woman is quite different from the experience that many, many people who go through the prison system or the court system experience. But, I think that I speak from my own experience on a fundamental level. But I am very typical in many senses, even though, you know, you might think demographically I'm not typical. You know, I'm a low-level nonviolent drug offender, just like many, many millions of people who have filled up our prison and jail cells.
And one of the critiques that has come up is that some of the people of color on the program are playing stereotypical roles. Do you have a response for people who think maybe they those characters aren't as developed as they could be?
I mean, I think that one of the creative choices that Jinji and her team made is to present many, many different protagonists. So the show is not built around a single protagonist, like, you know, let's say Breaking Bad or some of the other television series that we've seen, like Mad Men or something. And I think that's why audiences have responded so powerfully to the show, is because every single episode, another woman steps sort of into the spotlight and we learn more about her backstory, and we learn more about who she is as a person. I think that you'll see a lot more of that in the second season. I think that the actresses are amazing, and I think that the show does a really great job.
I've been speaking with Piper Kerman. She's the author of Orange is the New Black, which has become a Netflix series. She's speaking this evening at 5:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue here in Portland. And it is a benefit for the Partnership for Safety and Justice, one of the main groups in Oregon that's been working on criminal justice reform here in the state of Oregon. Thanks so much for joining us today, Piper Kerman.
Oh, thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
President Obama visited the site of the Oso, Washington mudslide on Tuesday. Besides seeing the devastation created, the president also witnessed the tremendous support provided by the community and volunteers from the surrounding area. The president met with the victims of the mudslide, as well as first responders. While many people in this area are fairly conservative, there was widespread enthusiasm in response to the president's visit.
The Oregon Department of Transportation has announced its intention to stop collecting records on the transportation of hazardous materials from railroad companies in the state. This comes after inquiries by the Oregonian to obtain full records on the crude oil moved by train through the state. The newspaper succeeded in getting the information, but not a complete record. An ODOT spokesperson has said that their records are incomplete and that railroad companies are not required to submit full records to the Department of Transportation. However, the ODOT Rail Administrator was able to give this information to transportation commissioners for the year of 2012. Railroad companies are required by state law to submit the details of any volatile cargo transported through Oregon, but it's unclear where and to what agency the information should be submitted. Emergency responders around the state need to know where hazardous materials are located, but they've had a hard time getting that information from the Department of Transportation. ODOT has collected this information from railroad companies in the past in order to get it to the appropriate safety inspectors. But now, ODOT officials say that they have no use for that information, and that if the safety inspectors need it, they can obtain it directly from the railroad companies. This change will affect access to information necessary for public safety, information which has already been difficult to obtain. It will also affect ODOT's ability to regulate the highly flammable materials which pass through the state. The announcement comes at a time when several new oil and company terminals are being proposed throughout Oregon, which would vastly increase the amount of these fuels transported by train in Oregon. Last year alone, the amount of oil transported by rail in Oregon increased by 250%.
An unusual partnership called the Cowboy Indian Alliance arrived in Washington, D.C. yesterday to campaign against the Keystone XL pipeline. The alliance is made up of people that live near the proposed path of the Keystone pipeline. They marched down Independence Avenue on Tuesday before setting up teepees at the National Mall. The Cowboy Indian Alliance plans to camp all week to ensure their voices of opposition to protect our herd. Gary Doerr is an organizer with Reject and Protect who coordinated the demonstration, and he spoke with KBOO reporter Robin Ryan about the week-long event. He discussed some of the long-standing nation-to-nation agreements between the U.S. and tribes that are likely to come into play during these negotiations.
I know that your contingent arrived in Washington, D.C. to camp out on the National Mall yesterday. What has been the reception to your presence and the message by the nation's capital?
We have some meetings scheduled with the White House. We did a march yesterday down Independence Avenue, and generally the feeling from the people there was they supported us, and they said, keep doing what you're doing. We've met with people in the camp, and we've actually had some people that supported the pipeline, and they talked with us and found out a few of the facts. And personally, I've had three people come up to me and talk in that manner, and we've converted them from supporting it to now being against it, knowing the ecological harm that it can cause.
Is there any variation of how you deliver your message depending on whether you're in a dialogue directed at legislators, or is it different than what you might say to a federal agency or a regulatory authority?
Well, when we speak to the regulatory agencies and the federal agencies and a couple of other groups, we talk about the treaties. And the 1851 and 1868 Fort Laramie treaties spell out what was protected for the Rosebud Sioux Indian tribe, or actually the Great Sioux Nation. So we talk about the treaty language and the reserved rights that are still retained, and part of that is the resources and the water. Another aspect of that is the government-to-government consultation, because we are a treaty tribe, so that's how we deal with the federal government. You know, we don't consult with states or federal agencies. We consult on a nation-to-nation basis with the United States federal government.
Well, how far have people traveled to participate in this demonstration?
In the camp, we have people that are here from South Dakota, from the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation, the Pine Ridge Reservation, Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, which is up in Bridger, South Dakota. We have folks here from Canada, from Nebraska, and we have actually the local tribes, the Piscataway tribe from West Virginia, which claims this land as their homeland, they're actually here. And we've had people come up from Texas also. We have a landowner who was arrested on her own land for protesting the eminent domain that was exercised on her land. So we have people from all over the states and Canada.
The administration announced late last week that a decision on the pipeline is going to get delayed until after the election cycle is concluded. Do you think there's an argument to be made for suggesting the political realm at large fears some public backlash at the voting booth?
Well, I think the current political environment, there's going to be backlash either way. So when you make that decision, it has to be morally and ethically a sound decision. It doesn't matter when it's made, because you're going to have people on each side saying, well, you need to do this or you need to do that. What we look at is a moral standard for rejecting the pipeline. And I think the greatest example is asking yourself if you'd want this 36-inch pipe under 1,600 PSI with four carcinogenic chemicals running through your backyard. And the president needs to ask that question of himself. And what would Sasha and Malia do if they were living in South Dakota and their water supply was suddenly polluted forever?
How long does the Cowboy Indian Alliance plan to remain on site? And can you share with us what the next steps might be?
We're going to stay here until Sunday, and Saturday will be the closing ceremony, and then Sunday will be an interfaith prayer service so that we can bring the prayers of all the people who are collected here. Now, the actions after this are we're continuing our petition, and we're continuing to write letters to senators and congressmen. We also have a couple of legal maneuvers to enact. The Nebraska contingent also has a delay in the pipeline in that they've overturned the state's eminent domain process and it's been declared illegal. They have to send that to the Public Service Commission, and then it has 7 months for a decision to be made. Meanwhile, in South Dakota, in late June, the permit for Keystone XL to be constructed runs out. It expires. They will have to resubmit and go through the entire process again, which could also be another 7 months. So this puts us beyond the midterm elections. And, you know, if you really, really look at it, there's all kinds of delays that are going into this. So We don't know when it's going to happen or if it will, but we are in it for the long haul. So as far as the next steps are legal steps because the programmatic agreement was flawed. It's a document where tribes were not consulted and our treaty and sacred sites and areas have not been properly surveyed, so we don't even know what's actually in the corridor.
I've been talking with Gary Doerr of Reject and Protect from Washington, D.C. For more information, you can visit the website at rejectandprotect.org. This is Robin Ryan reporting for KBOO News.
Lead is an extremely toxic element, but across the U.S., jet fuel, including lead components, is used to power many of our airplanes and helicopters. This week, three advocacy groups petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency to address the health risks from leaded aviation gas. Friends of the Earth, Oregon Aviation Watch, and Physicians for Social Responsibility filed the petition. Close to 200,000 airborne vehicles use the leaded fuel at some 20,000 airports. The impact is widespread, possibly affecting 16 million people. This includes 3 million children who attend schools near these airports. This is according to estimates provided by the Environmental Protection Agency. For more, visit OregonAviationWatch.com.
A former Mobil Oil executive has joined the opposition to the controversial oil and gas extraction process known as fracking. Louis Alstadt, a retired oil executive, said on Tuesday that he believes safe fracking is simply not possible. He spoke at a news conference held by a local group working to maintain the moratorium on fracking that is currently in place in New York State. Louis Alstadt's 31 years at Mobil Oil make him a prominent figure in the discussion, despite complaints that he lacks the technical background to speak on the issue. The prospect of oil drills near his home in Cooperstown, New York, drove Alstadt to research the potential local impact. He says that the laws maintaining drilling distances from residences and waterways are currently inadequate. Fracking requires large amounts of water, sand, and chemicals to be pumped deep into the earth. The technique has been criticized for its potential groundwater contamination risks. It's still unclear where Governor Andrew Cuomo stands on the issue or whether he'll maintain the statewide moratorium against fracking after the upcoming elections. Alstadt urged the governor to renew the statewide ban on the drilling method, at least until clear and concise regulations are in place.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with David Fedanke of the Oregon ACLU. He'll comment on today's potentially historic court hearing challenging Oregon's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. At 6, it's The Underground, KBOO's monthly youth collective show, produced entirely by kids under 21. The theme of tonight's show is spying. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather for the Portland area is a light April rain early in the day, then cloudy with showers in the afternoon, high of 56. Chance of rain is 90%. Today in history, William Shakespeare is believed to have been born in 1564. That makes this year, 2014, the 450th anniversary of the birth of Shakespeare. He also died on April 23rd on his 48th birthday in 1612. Our quote of the day comes from the great bard himself. A fool thinks himself to be wise, but a wise man knows himself to be a fool.
It's 5:28, time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It doesn't take an IQ much higher than room temperature to realize that it's way past time to raise America's sub-poverty minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. But let's also pay attention to the millions of people trying to make ends meet on, believe it or not, America's sub-minimum wage. Some of our country's richest corporations have turned national wage laws into Swiss cheese, riddling them with special loopholes that let them escape paying even today's miserly minimum wage. This amounts to wholesale daylight robbery of restaurant workers, farm workers, domestic workers, pro football cheerleaders, taxi drivers, and, wait a minute, back up, cheerleaders? Yes, super-rich NFL football teams, which sop up billions of dollars in subsidies from us taxpayers, pay peanuts to their highly publicized cheerleading squads. Widely assumed to be a glamour job, it's actually a poverty job that requires long hours of arduous practice, involves frequent travel at their own expense for media appearances and charity events, and subjects the women to abusive treatment by supervisors. Members of the Oakland Raiders squad calculate that their pay works out to less than $5 an hour, while the Cincinnati Bengals cheerleaders, who bear the burden of being called Bengals, are paid about $2.85 an hour. Astonishingly, though, a recent ruling by the U.S. Labor Department says this does not violate federal law. Why? Because the macho sports industry got its cheerleaders categorized as, quote, seasonal amusement employees, a loophole that exempts them from our national pay rules. This is Jim Hightower saying the powers that be are trying to transform our land of opportunity into their low-wage plutocratic province. From farm workers to cheerleaders, we're all in this together, and it's time for us to get together to stop these plutocrats.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
22 Portland arborists got together in the rain yesterday to climb onto one limb of a massive paradox walnut tree. The tree, located in the Mount Tabor neighborhood, is threatened with being cut by developer Steve Melkerson. Melkerson has made conflicting statements about his intentions on the three-lot property at Southeast 50th and Mill. He acquired the property in order to build a 14-unit housing complex, which was approved by the city last month. The Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association is petitioning to save the tree and will hold a community meeting with the developer this evening. KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke earlier with local arborist Kevin Hillary, who organized yesterday's Earth Day event.
A bunch of arborists, about 30 arborists, got together in that wonderful weather, rain and hail, to climb the tree, to see how many arborists we could get on one single limb. And it was a really good turnout, which was interesting to me. Never happened before in Portland where my industry got together. These are my competitors, my colleagues. We don't always get along. The bunch of lone wolves getting together and climbing a tree was a little bit of a circus. But every single one of them were in solidarity that this tree really should stay. And none of them would participate in its removal, which I find very interesting. These guys are arborists who make their living out of taking down trees. And some of them came up to me afterwards and said they're weary of, and I am too, of taking down trees for infill, for the reason of squeezing more houses right up to property lines.
Well, yeah, I'd like to talk to you a little more about that, the broader issue involved here. But first, maybe you could talk about what's going on now. I know there's a meeting this evening. You're gonna meet with a developer.
So the developer is required to meet with the neighborhood, and he's gonna do that today at 6 p.m. at Tabor Space on Southeast 50th in Belmont. He's gonna give a statement and hear what the neighborhood has to say. After he has this meeting, he needs to send those comments to the city. The city will lift the administrative hold that's on the property. And after the hold is lifted, he can go ahead immediately with his original plan, or he can submit a new plan.
And you obviously have no way of knowing how that's going to go.
We don't. He's told a lot of different people exactly what they wanted to hear. Being a developer, he's trying to look good. So we're not completely sure what he wants to do. So we need a really good turnout today. And I think it'd be good news story that I found a lot of the neighborhoods and now people who are working on infill are tired of it. And that's a new news story for me.
So this issue of protecting urban trees and the fact that these arborists, you say, are getting tired because of so much, you know, tearing down of old houses, many of them perfectly good structurally. And of course, they're surrounded by more open space and going to these larger block-like complexes that tend to take up the whole lot or larger share of the lot. So a lot of trees had to be cut down. And then there's other things that are threatening, you know, perfectly healthy trees. So beyond a heritage tree designation, which that tree did not get because the previous landowner didn't ask for that designation, what kind of protection is there for individual trees, for stands of trees, for patches of urban forest?
There's no protection in the city of Portland for trees on private property. There are in a lot of other cities of this size and of neighboring cities like Lake Oswego. And what I found, I've been involved in saving a lot of trees in town. Port Orford at City Hall, Chief Joseph, Maples at Fort Vancouver, several others that I've always had help from the politicians, from City Hall, from state government. But with this tree, I had a lot of allies in the government, but nobody would go out of the way to try to bend the rules, to make exceptions, to save a tree. It doesn't seem like there's any Tom McCall's in our government right now.
Well, listen, Kevin, I really appreciate talking to you. And again, that meeting, when and where is it this evening?
6 p.m., 55th in Belmont, Southeast, that Tabor space.
Okay. Well, great. I've been speaking with Kevin Hillary, a local arborist with Whole Tree Works, who's been working to try to save this monumental paradox tree in Southeast Portland. Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Thanks, Paul.
And with KBOO News, this is Paul Rowland.
New information is being discovered in the investigation into the causes for the Como News helicopter crash in Seattle last month. Materials from the helicopter have been sent to Chicago and Toulouse, France, where they were originally manufactured as part of the ongoing crash reconstruction process. Investigators will also use flight simulators in Texas to try to determine what might have happened on that March day.
Yesterday, four Muslim American men sued the FBI for barring them from flying after they refused to inform on their communities. All four men were put on a secret no-fly list after refusing FBI agents' requests to spy or pose as extremists. None of the men have been accused of breaking any laws, and all are American citizens or legal permanent residents. They claim they were put on the list to try to force them into spying. The men were not told that they could not fly and say they only found out when they tried to board planes and were refused. The men were later approached again by FBI agents and told they would be removed from the list if they agreed to become FBI informants. One of the men was asked to pose as an extremist in a particular mosque, then report on his fellow worshippers. The men have been isolated from friends and family members and say they've lost out on work despite committing no crime. This is the latest chapter in a long history of threats and intimidation against Muslims by the controversial agency. The FBI has deported or threatened to deport legal visitors, jailed them on trumped-up charges, and threatened them for refusing to betray the privacy of their friends, families, and communities. Other Muslims have been placed on the no-fly list while overseas, which essentially forced them to agree to become FBI moles before they could return to their homes. The lawsuit seeks to have the men removed from the list and to have a legal system put in place to prevent the FBI from continuing to abuse the list.
Fallout stemming from a South Korean ferry that sank last week continues, with over 300 high school students on board feared to have perished. The South Korean government has forbidden the owners of the ferry company, as well as 44 executives and shareholders, from traveling abroad. Divers continue to search for survivors in the submerged vessel, but the chance of survival at this point is slim to none. Family members of the hundreds of teenagers on board the ship when it sank have been gathering in shock and grief and demanding answers from the captain, who abandoned ship while their kids were still on board. Seven of the ferry boat's 29 crew members are among the dead and missing, but the majority of the crew also abandoned the ship, while hundreds of passengers on board in order to save themselves. The cause of the ship sinking last week off the coast of Korea remains unknown.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, people across the country are still waiting for the results of the April 5th presidential election, as the Election Commission continues to delay the final vote count. The commission says that the final outcome of the election will be announced on May 14th. Partial results put former Afghan Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah in the lead with 44%. He is followed by former World Bank economist Ashraf Ghani with 33%. Abdullah was the runner-up in the 2009 election won by President Hamid Karzai amid allegations of irregularities and ballot fraud. The winner of the April 5th election will replace Karzai, who could not run again because of constitutional limits. The next president will oversee a transition, during which a majority of international troops will be withdrawing from Afghanistan. In addition, the next president of Afghanistan will face serious budget challenges and will inherit a large federal deficit. It is anticipated that the government will be about $400 billion short of the $2.5 trillion it has budgeted this year. This could result in no pay for civil servants and some key public programs being shut down. Afghanistan will need more than $7 billion annually for the next decade to fund the needed government infrastructure, police, and military, according to the World Bank. However, there are doubts about how much more revenue can be generated or if additional funds can be borrowed. The U.S. does not plan to provide any compensation or reparations to the people of Afghanistan for the 13 years of war and occupation that the country has been subjected to.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, April 23rd, 2014. As Palestinian leaders achieve a unity deal, Israeli warplanes attack Gaza and injure 7 civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Seven Palestinian civilians were wounded on Wednesday when an Israeli unmanned warplane fired missiles at a residential area in Beit Lahia town in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza announced that among those injured were 50-year-old man and 2 children who sustained moderate wounds. Eyewitnesses said that the strike hit a motorcycle. The attack came while Palestinian leaders from different political groups, including Fatah and Hamas, announced a unity deal during a press conference in Gaza City. On Wednesday midday, Palestinian delegation representing the PLO and Hamas officials announced the end of 7 years' division between the Hamas-led Gaza and the Fatah-led West Bank. During the press conference, the leaders authorized the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to start the process of forming a unity government and set a date for presidential and parliamentary elections. In the West Bank on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded several Palestinian communities, broke into dozens of homes and searching them, then kidnapped at least 14 Palestinians. Local sources said that troops kidnapped 6 Palestinians and caused property damage while searching their homes from the village of Burqa in the northern West Bank. 2 more Palestinians were taken by soldiers from the nearby Jenin city. 5 other men were kidnapped by Israeli troops during home searches in the southern West Bank city of Hebron and nearby villages, local sources reported. Moreover, a Palestinian youth was kidnapped by Israeli soldiers after searching his family home in the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 23rd, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Nick Porter, David Lessem, and Aaron Brand. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with journalist, author, and speaker Nomi Prinz about her most recent book, All the President's Bankers, a groundbreaking narrative about the relationships of presidents to key bankers over the past. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, on A Deeper Look, host Linda Olsen-Osterlin interviews Micah White and Justin Wittes about The After Party, a new organization launched by the founders of Occupy Wall Street. They hope it will be the future for a populist movement here in the U.S. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, on Between the Covers, host David Nyman interviews writer Lori Moore, who has earned a place among the best and most beloved of American writers. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, hosts S.W. Konzer and Jen Chavez will be talking about the independent film scene here in Portland. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the Donate Today button. Stay tuned now for a live interview conducted by KBOO's Aaron J. Bernard, and have a great evening.
Arguments were heard today in federal court challenging Oregon's ban on same-sex marriage. On the line, we have David Fidanke of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon to give us an update on the challenge. Good evening, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, so can you give us an update on what happened in court today?
Yeah, the courtroom was jam-packed. There were overflow rooms in both Eugene and in Portland, where the arguments were streamed, video and audio. We had, I think, a total of 12 or 13 attorneys representing various parties in the case. The case is there are two challenges to Oregon's ban on marriage between same-sex couples. The first was filed last October by Lake Paraguay and Leanne Easton on behalf of two couples. The second case is our ACLU case that was filed on behalf of two more couples in December, as well as we have Basic Rights Education Fund, the charitable arm of Basic Rights Oregon, as a plaintiff as well. And we have a team of seven attorneys. In our case, we had five of those attorneys in the courtroom today. Then appearing on behalf of the state in defense of the marriage ban, although now taking the position on behalf of the state that Measure 36 is unconstitutional under the federal constitution, there were four attorneys, including Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum and former Deputy Attorney General Mary Williams, who did the lion's share of the argument for the state. And finally, we had attorney from County Counsel's office on behalf of Multnomah County, who were the other defendants in the case. And the plaintiffs went first, that is, our side went first, arguing why the ban on marriage for same-sex couples violates the federal constitution. Lake Paraguay started things off talking about the history of cases holding that the liberty protections under the Fifth Amendment to the federal constitution include the fundamental right to marry. He was followed up by Misha Isaac, one of the ACLU volunteer attorneys, arguing the equal protection arguments under the 14th Amendment and why the marriage ban violates the Equal Protection Clause. And the judge, Judge Michael McShane, U.S. District Judge, who's was appointed and confirmed about a year ago and just officially sworn in this week, asked very insightful questions of all of the lawyers. He obviously had read the briefs carefully that had been filed by all of the parties and had read most, if not all, of the court cases that were cited in the briefs, as well as a number of the other cases that are percolating up through the courts now around the country. As you probably know, there have been a multitude of challenges to marriage bans filed. I think the current count is that there are 70 pending challenges to marriage bans in various states around the country. In the 33 states that still have marriage bans in place. A number of those have already been decided by district court judges, 11 of them, I believe, since we won the case in the U.S. Supreme Court overturning the Defense of Marriage Act last June. That's the Windsor case. And every judge that has looked at these issues has found that marriage bans against same-sex couples violate the federal Constitution. Not a single judge since the Windsor case came down has upheld a marriage ban. So obviously we're optimistic that Judge McShane will decide the case in our favor, but we're not taking anything for granted.
Let's talk a little bit about Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum's decision not to defend the state's current ban in court. What was her reasoning?
Well, I think it's important to note that even though the Attorney General's office is agreeing that the marriage ban violates the federal Constitution, they are continuing to enforce it. And that's very important because it means that we have both people's rights continuing to be violated, it means we also have a live controversy in the court case. So the primary argument today was made by Mary Williams, who until late December was the Deputy Attorney General. She retired, but she's come back as a special assistant working on this case. And Mary Williams for the state laid out the fact that the state recognizes domestic partnerships of same-sex couples and provides many of the rights of marriage to same-sex couples. And when the domestic partnership law was approved by the legislature in 2007, at the urging of a broad coalition, including the ACLU and Basic Rights Oregon, the legislature made findings. And among the findings the legislature made were that same-sex couples had long-term committed relationships that should be recognized by the state, should be treated as equally as possible by the state, and that they have families that also are entitled to protection, and that those couples are fully capable of having committed loving relationships and of taking care, excellent care, of their children and families, and that the state had an interest in fostering those families. So Mary Williams pointed out, again on behalf of the state, that many other states, including Nevada, which has a case currently before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in our area, do not have a law like that on the books and are arguing the opposite. They're arguing that same-sex couples are not capable of having long-term committed relationships and of raising families equally as well as heterosexual couples. And so with that, with all of the protections that are currently in law, and with those findings that were made by the legislature back in 2007, the state is saying there is no rational basis for denying the right to marry to same-sex couples in Oregon that the state can make, and that therefore the ban on marriages by same-sex couples, it cannot pass a constitutional test under any standard of review whether that standard of review is heightened scrutiny or just a much lower standard of having a rational basis. So that was very moving to hear. The judge was listening carefully, and I think, you know, obviously was following that part of the argument very closely.
Well, this brings up a point I think many listeners may be wondering about, which is what happens if a state doesn't stand up in court to defend a ban that its citizens voted in? Is this like a basketball game where if one side doesn't show up, there's a forfeit?
Well, there's never a forfeit in a federal court case or in any court case where you have a state, the representative of the state saying that they are going to continue enforcing the ban that is in the Oregon Constitution until the judge rules in this case, at least until that point. So it's great for us that the state is agreeing with our legal arguments and amplifying those arguments in the way that they have. But in no way is this a cakewalk. I mean, the judge asked today all the lawyers to respond to the question of whether he should impose a stay if he does rule in our favor, given the number of other cases that are moving forward in the courts. He wanted to hear what the parties had to say about whether he should hit the pause button on a ruling if he rules in our favor, pending the outcome of the other cases in the Ninth Circuit. And all of the attorneys, both the plaintiff's lawyers, the state and Multnomah County, said, no, you should not impose a stay. The facts here are different than in any other state, and all of the parties in the case currently will abide by the court's ruling and do not plan to appeal. So, and beyond that, the same-sex couples who cannot marry will continue to be injured in a way that violates the federal constitution the longer any ruling that he makes is on hold. So the lawyers argued very forcefully that against him issuing a stay if he rules in our favor.
Let's talk a little bit more about the motion to intervene that the National Organization for Marriage filed earlier this week. Why are they allowed to petition? Didn't the Supreme Court recently rule that groups like them don't have standing in these types of cases?
Well, you can always file motions. You can always file petitions. You know, we are hoping that Judge McShane denies their motion to intervene. We believe they don't have standing to intervene and certainly would not have standing to appeal a ruling in our favor. But that doesn't mean they won't try. And the judge is taking that question, like all of the others related to this case, very seriously. He's asked for briefing from all of the current parties in the case, and those briefs are due on this motion to intervene. We'll be filing those briefs a week from Friday, May 2nd, and he's scheduled oral argument on that issue of intervention on May 14th. And he said in a written order yesterday, after denying NOM's motion to postpone today's hearing, that he would not issue a ruling before that hearing on May 14th, and that depending on how he resolves that motion, if he grants their motion to intervene, he'll allow further briefing in the case, or he'll set the case for a trial. Obviously, there's a potential that the National Organization for Marriage, which, you know, is an openly anti-LGBT organization based in Washington, D.C., there is the potential that they will be able to slow down this case enough that we will have to go forward with the marriage ballot measure campaign for the November election. That's not a done deal yet. We're doing everything we can to get a speedy resolution and to make sure that that the National Organization for Marriage cannot hold the case hostage. But, there are many twists and turns the case could take before we get to any final resolution. So it's just too soon to know.
Well, we have about a minute and a half left, David. Looking at the bigger picture, what is allowing same-sex couples to marry in Oregon going to do for our state?
Well, you know, we heard from again and again in court today that any state law that prohibits people from marrying merely because of who they are and who they love violates the federal constitution, and that kind of discrimination can no longer stand unchallenged or be allowed to continue in the United States, and certainly not in the state of Oregon. If we're able to prevail, and we certainly hope we will, either in court or at the ballot box this year, it's going to mean for thousands of couples in Oregon finally being able to go through marriage ceremonies that will last forever. And that's, you know, our clients have talked repeatedly about how meaningful that would be for them. Chris Tanner and Lisa Chickadance have been together more than 30 years, they've raised children together, and it would be incredibly meaningful to them and all of our other clients and all of the other couples around the state of Oregon who want to share their love and commitment with their family and friends and have that commitment be recognized by all Oregonians would be huge.
This has been Aaron J. Bernard for KBOO News in Depth, speaking with David Fidanke of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Aaron.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Organizing and Winning for 21st Century Movements, Wednesday, May 7th, 7:15 p.m. at Portland State University. The speakers for this event will be Steve Early, author of Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress, journalist Aaron Gupta, founder of The Independent and the Occupied Wall Street Journal, and Joanna Brenner, retired PSU faculty member who writes on feminist theory and politics. Again, that's Wednesday, May 7th at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 238 at 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Don Merrill, and I've been talking to as many Oregon State judicial, legislative, and gubernatorial candidates for 2014 office as I can. And I've been talking to them all. Deep blue, progressive, liberal, democratic, centrist, independent, Republican, conservative, libertarian, deep red. Many of these candidates get ignored by the mainstream media, but they're not ignored here.